It's a special day. It's the shortest day of sunlight for the year, meaning every day after this, the days get longer and we have something to hope for. And it is the final live episode of Today in Ohio in 2021. It's the news podcast discussion from Cleveland.com and The Plain Dealer. And after today, we'll be on break till January 3rd. But we do have three special episodes already recorded that we'll publish across the next week and a half. I'm Chris Quinn. I'm here with Lisa Garvin, Laura Johnston, and on her day off, Layla Atassi, who has a special surprise at the end of this podcast. You want to listen until the end. We're not going to give it away here. We got a lot of big stuff to talk about for our final episode, including a story that's just publishing this morning, and we will start there. Do public records show that Cuyahoga County Executive Armin Budish had a written plan for using the powers of his office to seek revenge against county council members who publicly criticized him? Layla, we've talked about a lot of jaw-dropping stories involving Armin Budish. Yeah. There is no bigger jaw-dropper than this one. This is astounding.
This is about as big a bombshell out of his administration as you can imagine. I mean, it comes to us via the treasure trove of documents that the Attorney General's office handed over to reporter Corey Schaefer in response to his public records request. These were the documents that were seized from Budish's office during a raid in 2019. Among these were two pages of Budish's handwritten notes sketching out a retaliation plot against the county council members who he had deemed antagonistic to him and his administration. I mean, if carried out, these plans would have jeopardized services in a whole bunch of districts. I mean, they included pulling back support for road and bridge repair projects and economic development efforts and in districts of certain council members. The scheme called for closing or consolidating county offices in those districts and introducing divisive resolutions and legislation to council, including an ordinance that provided certain legal protections for LGBTQ people. I mean, Budish also considered introducing a resolution to cut council members' salaries in retaliation. I mean, and when Corey Schaefer confronted Budish about this, Budish released a statement that said, "Obviously, I was angry, and these were private thoughts in the heat of the moment. I regularly write things down to vent, but after calming down, I never acted on any of these things. I've always acted only in the best interest of the people of Cuyahoga County." I mean, it.
Okay.
Yeah.
All right. So there's so much to unpack here. I should say at the outset, the reason these documents are in the hands of investigators is because Dave Yost has been running a completely bogus criminal investigation of Armin Budish. They tried to criminalize incompetence and bad decision making. And so, you know, in that respect, all of his private papers have been scooped up and put into the public domain for really bad purposes. And Dave Yost should be ashamed of himself and close that investigation down, because clearly they don't have a criminal charge against him. But for Armin Budish to say, "Oh, I was angry and I didn't act on it," what this shows is how his mind works.
Exactly.
The minute somebody was critical of him, mm-hmm. he was going to penalize them by taking services away from the residents of their district. Forget for a moment that Armin Budish was elected to serve everybody, not just the people who live in wards of praising council members. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. This is not what you're supposed to do in that job. You're not supposed to use your powers to bring people into line with your way of thinking. This is as venal as anything I've ever seen.
Right.
And he wrote it down. I mean, it was all, and it's not typed. It's handwritten notes. It's inescapable that he sat there and plotted. Plus, Layla, the other thing is, this wasn't just some private act of note making. He had conversations with three of his top administrators about whether to do these things.
Oh, God,
that is also part of Corey's story.
Right, right, right. And, you know, I mean, this shows that he has the thinnest skin. I mean, there's one key example, striking example. You know, former Councilman Dan Brady had criticized Budish during an endorsement interview with our, you know, editorial board for Brady's reelection bid. And Budish's administration, you know, obviously plagued by a host of scandals over the previous year. And When asked whether counsel had been vigilant in overseeing Buttigieg's administration, Brady said it had not, but he complained that Buttigieg's cabinet members regularly didn't answer questions at council meetings, and he said the administration needed to reorganize itself. I mean, okay, right? You roll with those punches. But instead, Buttigieg took notes of the critical comments that he made and wrote in his notebook, "How fight back?" And he wrote that he still, you know, needed to maintain a relationship with some council members. And, you know, but he wrote that he could oppose big projects as they come up. That is a quote. And he specifically mentioned holding money for the Euclid Lakewood revitalization project that saw some of the council, county council in the city of Euclid, spend more than $5 million to build this lakefront park. And he was most offended, it seems, that Brady had made his criticism public. Like, that really stuck in his craw. And in his notes, he wrote, "Can we repair relationship and get back to a proper balance? Or is this the new norm? If this is the new norm, they can stop my spending, but I can stop theirs too." What?
Yeah, it's,
who behaves, you know, this way?
you're not supposed to behave this way. This is really as bad as it gets. One of the people he was targeting was Chantel Brown, the Cuyahoga County Democratic Party chairwoman, and now a congresswoman from Northeast Ohio. I don't know that she was aware that he was plotting against her. This is the kind of thing that Larry Householder would do in the legislature. It's my way, or I'll stick it to you. When we recreated county government, it was supposed to get away from this kind of singular control. It was all supposed to be about serving the residents, and he didn't care about the residents. What this shows is it was always about Buttigieg. Mm-hmm. It was always about him first above all others. People ought to pay attention. He's not going away. He's not going to run again, but he's clearly going to get behind a candidate. Him and his chief of staff, Bill Mason and his machine, Wondolowski, the union guy. People ought to pay attention to who they support in this county executive race, because they're going to be trying to put somebody in that does this kind of stuff instead of somebody that wants to serve the residents. This is as bad as it gets. I've never seen anything. Plus, how stupid can you be to write this stuff down?
I know.
It's like, what are you thinking, man?
This is stuff for like the diary that goes under your pillow at night. Like, you don't put this in your office.
Actually, Layla, I would argue that the minute these thoughts come into your head, you need to shake them off and say, that's not who I am. I need to serve the residents regardless of criticism. Part of the job is to be criticized. And you take the criticism, you consider it, you act on the stuff you think is legitimate, and you move on. You don't immediately aim to harm the people who are criticizing
right,
you.
Right,
it is
right.
Such a bad exercise. Great,
you know,
story.
To your point, though, about the endorsement, I got to believe that his endorsement of any candidate would be totally radioactive. I mean,
but it's not just his endorsement. It's the Bill Mason. It's Wondolowski. It's a bunch of these folks. They're the same people that were behind Kevin Kelly.
Bill Mason hasn't been squeaky clean lately either. If I were running for county council, you know, or for county executive, I wouldn't want either one of their endorsements.
No, but they'll be moving in the background, and people need to pay attention. Whoever they get behind, it's not for good. It's not for good reasons. And this is all the evidence you need. You know, if he had decided to run again, this would have done him in. I mean, there's no way you're going to win with this in your background.
Right.
It's a great story by Corey Schaefer. Check it out on cleveland.com. It just went up this morning. It'll be in the Plain Dealer, I think, tomorrow, right, Laura?
Yes.
Okay. Let's move on. You're listening to Today in Ohio. Marijuana activists turned up the heat a notch in their push to get lawmakers to fully legalize the drug. What method are they using to squeeze the lawmakers into action? Laura, this is a great exercise of democracy. It's like, if the lawmakers don't do this, they face serious consequences in November.
Right. They're going to face a referendum, and we'll see what the popular vote wants. So they submitted 206,943 signatures to Ohio Secretary of State Frank LaRose. They obviously need to verify these signatures, but the group says they did that as they went along. They got to make sure that they are registered to vote. They live where they said they do. They don't sign more than once, all that other stuff. Once they are verified, the proposal goes before the General Assembly. They get the first stab at creating a law based on this petition. And if that fails, the proposal goes on the ballot as a statute. And actually, the campaign would prefer it if the legislature passes a law I mean, because I guess that's a sure thing, but they're saying, hey, we can go to the voters and we can ask them what they think about marijuana, that under this law, Ohioans ages 21 and older could buy and use marijuana and they could grow up to 6 plants per person, 12 plants per residence.
Oh, Laura, I think you're being too soft. Their entire purpose here is to get them to pass a law. And the threat is, don't pass a law, we'll put this on the ballot and it'll bring Democrats out to vote in all the statewide elections. I mean, it's a legal form of blackmail. Pass the law, legalize marijuana, or we'll have something that fills the ballot booth with people who are not your friends. And, you know, I suspect the legislature will cave to this for that very reason. The fact that they haven't done it yet, that they haven't started it yet, is why you see things like this. Now it's another notch closer. Now we got the signatures. That means it'll be pushing toward the ballot eventually. I mean, there's a step in between, right? They get the signatures. It forces the legislature to make a decision. If they don't act on it, they get more signatures and it goes on the ballot, right?
Yeah, that's my understanding. And you're right. But isn't this what happened with the medical marijuana in the first place? The reason that we have a law is because they said, hey, you know, we're going to take this to the voters. But we ended up with a law that was kind of not as strong as some people would like. So I don't know. Does this end up going before the voters so they get exactly what they want?
No. I think the legislature will cave and pass this before too long. I mean, that's what we're hearing, that the legislature is seriously considering it. We'll have to see. The chips are on the table. It's time to show some cards. You're listening to Today in Ohio. After months of lagging much of Ohio in coronavirus case rates, Cuyahoga County has leapt to the top of the charts, not just for the state, but the entire nation. Lisa, this is one of the saddest stories we've had in a month. Where do we rank, unfortunately?
This was breathtaking. When I read it, I thought, wow, how did this happen and so fast? Cuyahoga County is number 3 in the nation for the number of COVID cases. We're now sitting at 180 cases per 100,000 population. We're 3rd only to Tompkins County, New York, and Pike County, Illinois. Also, Cuyahoga County is the 4th highest in the nation for daily average cases, the daily average case rate, I should say, which sits at 2,221. And this is all according to a coronavirus tracker that the New York Times puts out. This is kind of frightening. I mean, a friend of mine invited me to a Christmas Eve party with people I don't know. And now I'm like seriously reconsidering that because I'm going to be with my mom the very next day. So this is kind of frightening news to me anyway.
I spent yesterday reading the more than 400 emails that people sent me about their experience with breakthrough cases. And it's got me so overly sensitive now about it. And I'll be putting something together on the takeaways. But the biggest takeaway is that the vaccine and the booster does not stop you from getting sick. It just keeps you from getting really sick and dying. I heard from so many people that are in that situation. I wonder if the reason we're so high is that we're a very dense population county and people are close together. When you have a super contagious variant, bars are crowded, restaurants are crowded, theaters are crowded, and Cavs games. I've heard from people that suspect they got it at the Cavs game, that because of our close proximity, it's just spreading more quickly than it does in rural areas, which had been leading the state. Laura, right. We're going to be looking into that. I bet we can't get an answer, though.
Right. I don't think that we're going to have an answer that's definitive. But yeah, this raises a lot of questions. I've been thinking about it because for so long, for, you know, nearly 2 years, Cuyahoga was not leading the state. You know, we were red when we did those red counties back in the day. But for the most part, we kind of looked at ourselves like, look, we're wearing masks, we're following the rules. Those rural people, they don't have the vaccines and they're not protecting themselves. And then all of a sudden it was like, we just erupted in flames. And I understand the density issue because we're talking about a more contagious variant and we are closer together. But I want to know why Columbus and Cincinnati are not in the same boat. And what about places like Pittsburgh or Indianapolis?
Or Michigan.
Why is it so bad here? Right. Or Detroit.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I don't know. Maybe we're just more dense. Ha 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 ha.
Yeah. And we're also, you know, we have hospitalizations are high all across the Midwest and New England. But so it's even more weird that Cuyahoga County stands out. And,
right.
And with Omicron now, basically health people are saying everybody's going to get Omicron vaccinated or not, you know? So yeah,
but the people who are vaccinated and especially with the booster, they're not getting deathly ill. The hospitalizations are largely still unvaccinated people. Not all by any means, but the evidence is very clear that if you have that booster, yeah, you're going to get it. If you're exposed to it, you're very likely to end up with it, but you're not going to die and you're not going to end up with your lungs torn to pieces. You'll be
right. But you could be passing it along without knowing. That's the problem, you know? So,
right. No, it's scary how prevalent it is in Cuyahoga County. And I imagine a lot of people are reanalyzing their holiday plans as you are. You're listening to Today in Ohio. We wonder during the criminal trial of former Cuyahoga County Jail Director Ken Mills, whether County Executive Armin Budish, yes, we're talking about him again, would take the Fifth Amendment and decline to testify if called as a witness. Now we know, Layla, yep. What's the answer?
Yes, indeed. Pleading the Fifth was very much under consideration had Budish been called to testify, according to a memo recently released by the Attorney General's office. However, turns out 2 months before the trial, Budish's lawyer approached the AG's prosecutors with an offer that Budish would testify against Ken Mills in exchange for a non-prosecution agreement protecting Budish. The AG's lawyers contemplated the pros and cons of that decision and memorialized their thinking in the documents that Corey Schaefer obtained. So on one hand, prosecutors felt that they could use Budish to highlight the overall dysfunction of Cuyahoga County government. Specifically, they could highlight how the county executive appoints both the sheriff and the jail director, which allowed Mills to circumvent the sheriff and create so much harm in such little time. Prosecutors believe that because Budish set the county policy and hired its personnel, he would be the best person to testify about how the chain of command worked and what he expected out of Mills as his jail director. If they allowed Budish to testify without the proffer, he could have invoked his Fifth Amendment, and they could have bolstered Mills's argument that people above him were really to blame and they should be facing the charges instead of him. So, you know, the prosecutors felt that perhaps that would be a bad idea. On the other side of the ledger of pros and cons was this very telling quote from the document. They said, people close to Budish have described him as a micromanager with a tin ear for common sense. In short, we expect Budish to be a bad witness who will want to argue, rationalize, and deflect blame on everyone but himself. So they thought he would have some real credibility problems. And, you know, if Budish did blame Mills, defense attorneys would still present their main defense that he was merely a middle manager being unfairly scapegoated to cover for Budish and the sheriff, Cliff Pinckney. So, you know, in the end, prosecutors decided they really didn't need Budish's testimony because several other high-ranking county officials would testify to the dysfunction. So that's kind of all of the, you know, everything that factored into their calculus here, and just really fascinating documents.
That's what you want on your tombstone, right? Had a tin ear for common sense. It's just makes you feel like you're living the good life. I do think it's very odd that this document was included in the records. It's almost, I mean, this is not the kind of document that normally gets released. It's very much, you know, lawyer negotiation. So I'm surprised it's there. It almost seems like they wanted us to find it. But now that it's there, of course, it's very newsworthy that the highest ranking elected official in the county was going to exercise his right against self-incrimination rather than seek true justice for what had happened at the jail. It speaks volumes about it. He has the right to do it. Everybody has the right to do it. But if he would have done that in a courtroom, it would have been very damning for him. Mm-hmm. I do think the way the prosecutors decided not to use him because he'd be such a terrible witness is kind of hilarious, but it was right. They convicted Ken Mills, who is sitting in a cell right now, without ever having called him. They did say, though, in the documents, they had planned to put him on the stand on the second day of trial.
Right, right. And I remember us feeling, or at least I felt like it was really letting Buttigieg off the hook entirely by not calling him. And this shines a light on their logic in a way that makes me double think what I had concluded about that, because I think they're right. I mean, I think he would have been a terrible witness, and some, you know, his testimony would have reinforced Mills's defense in a way that would have, you know, been detrimental to the case. So very interesting.
He's going to have one of the absolute worst legacies of any elected county official, absent Jimmy DeMora and Frank Russo. I mean, every time we talk about him, it's another. I mean, last week it was about his secret dealings on the jail and the conflict of interest in the site selection company. And earlier it's about, you know, his venal revenge plan. And now it's about taking the Fifth. I mean, geez, this is just in the course of 1 week on top of everything else that's gone on. Amazing stuff in those records. And we're going to have to tease. We have one more story coming from those records that will probably publish next week. You're listening to Today in Ohio. How is Case Western Reserve University using technology to detect counterfeit paintings? Laura, this is a cool story. They sent us the press release about, and Steve Litt jumped all over it. Steve Litt is our art critic, and he knows how these things work.
Yeah, this is really neat. It's using artificial intelligence to basically check the provenance of a painting. So a team of art historians and scientists can work together to make sure they know with certainty which artist made a particular painting. And it's based on these tiny details of brush marks that cannot be controlled by the artist and are not visible to the naked eye. So you could you could be an expert and look, but this computer program can do it much better. It combines data from precise three-dimensional mapping of the painting's surface, and it analyzes that. And this is breaking completely new ground, and they feel like there's going to be a lot of uses in the future to identify fakes. And as a really cool kind of offshoot, know that some of these masters in their workshops worked with a lot of other artists, and they kind of mass-produced paintings, sort of, and they'll be able to tell who created which part of which painting.
How depressing would it be to have lots of money and have spent it on a painting only to have Case come along and say, you got scammed. This isn't really who you think it is.
Yeah, it's like a fingerprint almost. And you can't see it, but the computer figures out how to do it. It's really a neat blending of art and science.
There's a lot of thought that there are quite a few counterfeits out there. So it'll be interesting to see how many people are willing to put theirs up for the test. Good stuff by Steve Litt. Check it out on cleveland.com. It's Today in Ohio. How are restaurants, theaters, and other entertainment venues coping with the fast spreading Omicron variant of the coronavirus, which in just a couple of weeks has wreaked havoc on the workforce and the general population? Lisa, it's amazing. As we talk about this, it feels like things are happening. I mean, as we talked yesterday, more and more things came about. The NHL has closed down their league. So how are the entertainment venues in Cleveland dealing with it?
This kind of has the feel of the very start of the pandemic back in March and April to me, because things are starting to close. People are starting to reevaluate, you know, the safety of themselves and their employees. So we saw a rash of cancellations of events over the weekend. That included the Cleveland Orchestra, the Cleveland Playhouse. They canceled their, you know, weekend events. Also, the KeyBank State Theater in Playhouse Square is canceling the Wicked shows. They canceled yesterday's and today's. So they're thinking even ahead past the weekend. In Rocket Mortgage Fieldhouse, NBA and NHL games and concerts are still on, but that's a moving target. We may see some cancellations there. The Trans-Siberian Orchestra, their two shows on the 30th are still a go, but again, that may change. The Agora Ballroom closed from the 12th, they're closing from the 20th, which was Monday, through January 3rd, but there's one show on the 29th that's still going on as we speak. Beachland Ballroom canceled all their late December events or postponed them. The owners tested and they were both positive, so they're quarantining. And Happy Dog, which has some shows, they closed last Saturday, but they're going to be closed through Christmas. The owner, Sean Waterston, said it is not worth the risk, and his staff was hit pretty hard by COVID. Also, too, we haven't seen a lot of restaurant closures, but we did report in Cleveland.com and the Plain Dealer that Zhug in Cleveland Heights on Cedar Road closed their dining room on the 18th, and it's going to be closed for several weeks, so they're just going to do takeout only. And I wonder if other restaurants will follow suit. We haven't heard that yet, but I eat at restaurants like two or three times a week, and so I'm starting to rethink that strategy as well.
Yeah, I love the ghost kitchens though, because you can still get the food. You just can't eat it there. You know, you mentioned the comparison to the early part of the pandemic. The difference this time, I think, is that so many of the workers are sick. That in the early part of the pandemic, it was, let's not get together because we don't want this to spread, but it wasn't spreading like it is now. Now you have so many people are getting it. It's hitting in a wide, wide swath of the population that they can't even do what they need to do to put people out there.
And can I ask, at the beginning of the pandemic, DeWine closed everything. We had public health orders. We have no public health orders right now.
No, but they're closing themselves because they don't have the people to do the work.
The business owners are taking it upon themselves to do something government won't do.
Which DeWine would argue is as it should be, because he's not going to tell business how to run itself.
Yeah, I would argue that.
You're listening to Today
in
Ohio. We've talked about the relative value of the Van Gogh exhibit in Cleveland, in which the artwork is projected all around you in an immersive experience. Some call it cheesy, but Ohioans suddenly have the chance for a much more authentic experience. Lisa, what is that?
We will actually get to see actual Van Goghs. 17 of them have been gathered together in this exhibit at the Columbus Museum of Art. The exhibition is called Through Vincent's Eyes, Vincent Van Gogh and His Sources. So, and this is looking at his works from 1880 to 1890, but alongside his works will be hanging similar works from his contemporaries, 140 works in all, from people like Edgar Degas, Edward Manet, Monet, et al., and also a lot of lesser known artists that were, influenced by him or he was influenced by them. And this exhibit includes quotes from letters that he wrote to his brother, who is an art dealer, Theo Van Gogh, and then diary entries that go along with some of these paintings. So it's nice to see in Van Gogh up close. We have a couple at the Cleveland Museum of Art, and you can really get in there and look at his brush strokes and his technique and everything. But this is an interesting way to see his work compared with people, his contemporaries of that decade. So it'll be very interesting. The exhibit has three paintings from Ohio museums, Cleveland, Toledo, and Cincinnati. And this runs through February 6, 2022.
We should send Case down there to see if they're all authentic. You're listening to Today in Ohio. Let's do this one quick because we have a surprise ending. Laura, what are the chances for a white Christmas this weekend? And when was the last one in Cleveland?
It's really not looking good. Last year, we had a true snowstorm. We had about 10 inches between Christmas Eve and Christmas Day. This year, I don't think we're going to be seeing anything. The latest I looked was about 50 degrees on Christmas. Historically, we have about a 50% chance of at least a 1 inch of snow on Christmas. But good luck, guys. I'm feeling you.
And it's supposed to rain, so it's not even going to be a nice warm day. Okay, you're listening to Today in Ohio. Let's get to this. Are we really going to end our final episode of the year with a song? Layla, you and Lisa participated in the long-held editorial board tradition of writing witty Christmas carols to the tune real Christmas carols. And you are the brave one. Are you really going to sing one of your carols?
Yeah, Chris, you twisted my arm and begged me to sing one of my carols live.
All right, that's just kidding.
I'm a shameless exhibitionist and told you I wanted to do this. So today, listeners will be treated to the world premiere of my carol about the Cleveland Indians' name change to the Guardians. It's called Let It Go to the tune of Let It Snow. And here we go. Oh, they finally came to their senses, and they ran out of moral defenses. The Guardians are the same team, you know, so let it go, let it go, let it go. It's a reference to transportation. They tried not to offend the Indian nation. Tom Hanks approves of it, so let it go, let it go, let it go. Sure, the roller derby had the name first, and we thought the baseball team might have to switch, but the decision couldn't really be reversed. So now the roller skaters are rich. Who knows if they can win a World Series? For more on that, Terry, Pluto has theories. But the new name upon you will grow if you let it go, let it go, let it go.
Oh, that was so good. Woo! I'm so impressed. Right. You have such a beautiful voice.
Yes, you do.
She does.
That is very well done. I there's nowhere else to go from here. Way to go. Thank you, Layla. Thank you, Lisa. Thank you, Laura. Thanks to everybody who listens to this podcast. Have a wonderful holiday. We'll be back on January 3rd.
Merry Christmas.
Merry Christmas.